Ever since Mitt Romney started his presidential campaign, he has at times been the subject of withering criticism from conservatives. But recently, critiques have reached a new level of intensity. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Some conservative columnists, commentators, operatives, and donors fret that Romney is losing control of the 2012 debate. This amid a Democratic assault on his personal finances and stewardship of Bain Capital. One of the things we'll look at on this Politics Wednesday. We'll also discuss a Republican in a competitive Iowa Senate district who not only withdrew from the race, but also rejected our system of government. Our political scientists this week, Dennis Goldford and Chris Larimer. Politics Day here on River to River starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday here on the program. Chris Larimer joining us from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. He's in our Cedar Falls studio where he probably is in stereo for some of you. Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Dennis Goldford, also with us, Professor of Politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Dennis, always good to have you.
Always good to be here. Hi, guys.
And if you'd like to join our conversation this hour, note this number. There may be something that tickles your fancy, that puts you on edge, that you would like to question or comment on. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's get right to the ad wars. President Obama's campaign this week released a new ad featuring a singing Mitt Romney.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of gray.
The ad, set to run in several battleground states, including Iowa, features a series of visuals that claim the GOP presidential candidate's business dealings resulted in jobs being shipped to Mexico, China, and that as governor of Massachusetts, he shipped jobs to India, that he has millions in Swiss bank accounts and tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Now, this ad is sparking questions about its tone, whether it's presidential as well as its content, whether it's truthful. A note here that fact-checker Glenn Kessler of The Washington Post has awarded two Pinocchios to one of the claims in the ad that Romney outsourced jobs to India as governor. I want to get your reaction to this. Let's start off with Dennis Goldford.
Well, you know, members, I think, of the press and Republicans in particular are always shocked and upset when Democrats actually fight back. And this is a particularly tough ad from the president's campaign. There's always the question of the extent to which all the claims in any particular ad are accurate or truthful. But this, I think, is certainly well within the bounds of political debate, in that Governor Romney has based his whole campaign on his claim that he's qualified to get the country out of its economic woes because of his experience with as a venture capitalist with Bain Capital. So he's made Bain fair ground. Now, that doesn't excuse inaccuracies, but he certainly made Bain a fair target.
Mm-hmm. What is the narrative that the Obama campaign is hammering on, and will this likely carry on right through to Election Day?
It's certainly the hypocrisy issue, claiming he wants to, the Governor Romney wants to create jobs and so forth, and the Obama people want to make the claim that, in fact, what his business experience consists of is wringing jobs out of various companies, shrinking the workforce. So they want to claim that Governor Romney, far from being a job creator, which is what's of main concern to most people, even more than the debt and the deficit, the fact that he was not a job creator.
Mm. River to River listeners, have you seen this ad on TV? What have you thought about it? Do you think that it strikes the right tone? Is it a presidential tone? 1-866-780-9100. Has it swayed you? 15 weeks until the general election. It seems like we're in the home stretch, the way this is intensifying. Chris Larimer, your thoughts at this point?
Well, I think on the ad, Dennis is right. You know, Democrats have historically been perceived as not running all that great of campaign ads, or certainly not all that powerful of ads. And, you know, if you're interested, there's a great book called The Political Brain by Drew Weston, who's a neuroscientist, and talks about the history of Democrats being unable to really run these powerful and very emotional ads. And now they have one, and it sets up a great contrast, right? It's the idea that Mitt Romney is disingenuous, that, you know, you have him in the background singing America the Beautiful, and then you're displaying all these facts that are, you know, or reported facts anyway, that, you know, he actually is hurting American jobs. And so I think it is a very powerful ad, but I doubt it's going to be the worst ad that we see before November.
Worse are yet to come. I want to remind our listeners that we have links to both of the ads. We'll have one from the Romney campaign in just a moment, as well as a link to the fact checker, Glenn Kessler of The Washington Post, on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, if you'd like to look in detail at the fact-checking on that or listen to one of these ads. The Romney campaign, of course, has its own ads, not taking this laying down. One of the latest features sound from then-presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton, who was, if you remember at that time, involved in a tight primary battle with then-candidate Obama.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
When a president doesn't tell the truth, how can we trust him to lead? The Obama outsourcing attacks, misleading, unfair, and untrue. There was no evidence that Mitt Romney shipped jobs overseas. Candidate Obama lied about Hillary Clinton.
So shame on you, Barack Obama.
But America expects more from a president. Obama's dishonest campaign, another reason America has lost confidence in Barack Obama.
The clip used in that ad, that very harsh clip from Hillary Clinton, refers to mailings the Obama campaign sent out that Hillary Clinton claimed distorted her record. Clinton has, though, recently called this Romney campaign ad, quote, a waste of money. What is the strategy, Dennis, of the Romney campaign using audio from now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in this ad?
Well, that is quite the harsh comment from now Secretary Clinton. I mean, that's a tough ad as well, no question about that. The context makes it look as though she's saying shame on you, Barack Obama, with regard to the matters that the Romney people are talking about. And, of course, as you said, they're not. It's a different issue. But they're trying to suggest that President Obama and his campaign are not truthful. I mean, one of the ways to undercut a charge against you is to make the claim that the people making the charge aren't being truthful. It reminds me of Bob Dole in, I think it was the New Hampshire primary. Chris, you may remember this. I think he was talking about the first President Bush, you know, quit lying about my record. Mm-hmm. That's a famous Dole comment. And the George Bush people in 2000 made all sorts of claims about questionable activities of Senator McCain in the 2000 Republican primary. So at one level, this is not new. But of course, with the expansion of social media and the internet and 24/7 campaigning, we just see a lot more of this now.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about perhaps, Chris, your thoughts on this about using Hillary Clinton in this way, considering that Barack Obama has a tremendous advantage, still double digit, I believe, in the polling with women in the country?
Yeah, I don't think that's probably going to have an effect on women voters. I think the idea was really just to undercut President Obama's credibility. The whole idea behind all of these ads is just to create a very simple image in the mind of voters, one that they can recall very easily when they get to the polling booth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very uncomplicated. It's just the idea that the president is being dishonest.
Mm-hmm. I can hear now many of our listeners screaming, isn't anybody talking about policy here? Are they?
Well, you don't want to talk about policy. If you start talking about all the details of policy, that's what Democrats have traditionally been criticized for in their ads, is that they try to paint this too complicated of picture, and voters really have no idea what they stand for. So I think what they're trying to do is make it a much simpler image for voters.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the question of tax returns, which is tied in with this. Regardless of what you may think of the contest of these battling campaign ads, a growing chorus of voices is calling for Mitt Romney to release more of his tax returns. He has released the 2010 and estimates for 2011, currently being prepared, he says. But on ABC This Week, political analyst and former speechwriter for President Bush, Matthew Dowd, and conservative columnist George Will spoke about the need for the Romney campaign to do more. Now, here's Dowd.
I have seen this with candidates. I saw this with the DWI with President Bush that came out late in the campaign. I've seen it with a number of other candidates that I worked for. I think it's two things. First of all, there's obviously something there, because if there was nothing there, he would say have at it. So there's obviously something there that compromises what he said in the past about something. So that's. But I think the bigger thing is it's arrogance. Many of these politicians think, I can do this, I can get away with this, I don't need to do this because I'm going to say something and I don't have to do this. And that, in the end, is the problem, is that they sort of walk into these paths, say, I don't have to do that, I can address it some other way. But he obviously, if he had 20 years of great, clean, everything's fine, it'd all be out there. But it is arrogance.
Absolutely. Look, what Mitt Romney has said is, he has released, and I quote, all that's necessary for people to understand something about my finances. Now, the something is a pregnant word. And people are going to say the costs of not releasing the returns are clear. Therefore, he must have calculated that there are higher costs in releasing.
And he's going to tough it out.
Matthew Dowd there, the voices of also George Will, George Stephanopoulos in that clip from ABC This Week. So Mitt Romney declining to release more than 2 years of his tax returns up to this point, returns from previous years when he wasn't running for president. There is no law that says a candidate must release his tax returns, but it's a note here that Mitt Romney's father set the precedent when he released 10 years of returns when he ran for president. What is the Romney campaign weighing in this decision not to release more returns? Chris Larimer.
Well, frankly, I'm a little confused by what they're weighing, because I think at this point, why, as you said, they're not required to do it, but it is an issue now. It's on the public's mind, and they're continuing to drag this out by not releasing the returns. And so, if at some point they eventually do have to release these, if they do it in October, if there are any folks who are undecided and there is a big surprise there, that's going to be detrimental to the campaign. So I'm a little surprised that they haven't tried to get this out and just get it over with, and then move on to the vice presidential pick, move on to the convention.
He's really caught in a vice here, a catch-22. If he doesn't release, this dominates potentially the campaign narrative. People imagine if he doesn't release more, he must be something really, should I say, baneful. Dennis, I thought you were going to jump on that before me. If he does release, the Obama camp may have plenty of new fodder for further attacks. What does he do, Dennis?
Well, see, this is the political equivalent of somebody taking the Fifth Amendment, privilege against self-incrimination. And you can certainly make the argument that that's entirely legitimate in a legal proceeding. But your average person would say, someone who says, I respectfully decline to testify and exercise my right against self-incrimination, people are suspicious when somebody takes the Fifth. And you think, well, what are you hiding? And this is the political equivalent of that. In other words, the fact that you're not doing what most people have done, which is to release the records of your financial records and so forth over a series of years, that creates the suspicion that there is something there. There may be, there may not be, although it's hard to figure out why otherwise you would refuse to do this. But I think the Democrats work this partly to put Governor Romney under a lot of pressure and behind the eight ball here. But also, one of their major themes is that while the Democrats will talk about income inequality, and I think they get way off target when they talk about the wealthy and so forth, what they're really after is this notion that's fundamental to being an American. It's the idea of equality of opportunity, that everybody has the chance to go out and make it to the best of his ability. And this sort of thing starts to raise the question about whether are there some people who are in such positions of wealth and power that they game the system, that they rig the rules. That's what Americans don't like. And that's why I think the Obama campaign is really pushing this particular button, because it puts Romney in the position of looking like someone who may in some way have gamed the system.
Politico.com today bringing out the fact that some conservative columnists, commentators, operatives, donors, they are fretting that Romney is perhaps losing control of the 2012 debate amid this Democratic onslaught on his personal finances and his stewardship of Bain Capital. Critics like conservatives like Charles Krautheimer, National Review editor Rich Lowry, Peggy Noonan, the former Reagan speechwriter, Rupert Murdoch, George Will, we heard there, William Kristol. So what are your predictions? Will he inevitably be forced to release more? Chris Larimer.
Yeah, that's a tough question. I really thought he would have done it by now to try to move past it. And then, you know, he has the vice presidential pick. He has the convention for kind of two positive events to sort of shift the campaign narrative. If he waits to do it, you know, until we get to September, October, then, you know, that creates a problem for any undecided voters that are left. You know, at this point, he's been unable to really, or the campaign has really been unable to shift the narrative of, as Dennis said, and I think that's a great point, is it's really about the image of fairness in the political system. And, you know, if there is some sort of violation of that fairness norm, that's going to be extremely detrimental to the campaign. So, you know, I really have no idea. I'm really confused at this point.
Do you have a prediction, Dennis?
Well, I would say, first of all, remember, it's very interesting to note that Governor Romney technically is not even the official nominee yet.
Mm.
That doesn't come until the convention the week before Labor Day. And if something blows up, could all of a sudden something change at the convention? So there's some interesting possibilities there.
So are you suggesting we could see a crash and burn of the Romney campaign before the convention?
Well, that's sort of drastic at this point. But I think they may but again, he's not the official nominee yet. And some states require that delegates vote for whoever won the primary on the first ballot, and they're released after that. Other states don't have their delegates committed. So I haven't done the math there to see what would happen. But that's just sort of a pretty far-fetched case, but it's interesting to note. But I think that, you know, the Romney folks may decide, you know, if you've toughed it out this far, they may think, is there anything more I can lose by continuing to stand fast? Or if I actually cave in now, do I lose more than just by continuing to take the heat by sticking to where I am? So obviously they're in the situation, as any politician would be, of wanting to control or at least make sure that the headlines are not about something that's going to embarrass you or otherwise hurt your candidacy. They want to control the narrative. And they've lost control of that for right now, which is why they keep trying to change the subject, like floating potential VP candidates' names or raising the issue of political cronyism on the part of the president. They're desperately trying to change the subject.
Chris Larimer, you mentioned the undecided voters, the electorate out there still making up their minds. What can be said about the part of the electorate still in the undecided column? How should we be thinking about it? I'm wondering if cement hardening is an image we should have. Is that correct as we proceed toward Election Day, now 15 weeks out, that sliver of undecided voters becomes ever slimmer and slimmer and slimmer? Or is it just not that way?
Well, you know, it is somewhat that way. But, I think for the independents out there, they're a lot of these independents are people who maybe were excited about Obama in 2008 and have really lost that excitement. So they're really weighing their options. You know, do I go back to the president at this point, or do I look for someone else? And, you know, really at this point, I think we've seen all the polls showing that most people are not all that excited about the election. They're fairly frustrated with the political system. They're frustrated with the economy. And so they're looking for something to excite them. And, you know, they're not getting that from either candidate at this point. And so, you know, if there's a certain narrative that's dominating the campaign and you know, one side allows the other side to dominate that narrative all the way up through October, that could have a pretty big effect as far as independents once they finally go to the polls.
Dennis Goldford, your thoughts on the undecided voter at this point. Perhaps we can reach out to our listeners. Are you undecided? Tell us, what are you weighing in your mind? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. And we're also on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Dennis.
There's a question of who the undecided voter is at this point. You know, are we talking more than 10% of the likely electorate? Is the undecided voter somebody who really has not been paying a lot of attention? And do you really want the whole race to depend upon people who haven't paid much attention? So, you know, there's a question there. I mean, I think in 2008, I got a little frustrated, you know, the final day or two, and people saying, well, gee, I just haven't made up my mind yet. And I meant no disrespect, but I thought, if at this point you haven't made up your mind yet, then you shouldn't be voting to begin with. You know, people would need to know. But I think that we can't overestimate the extent to which people have been paying attention up to this point. We have. But for most people, this is still background noise, even if so much of this has been so prominent so early. I mean, it almost feels like the last week of October in terms of the number of ads we've been seeing here in Iowa. you know, the whole thing could depend upon what people do in 9 states or 11 states, because all the other states seem to be pretty much set in stone one way or the other way, Democratic or Republican. But I think that we will have a hiatus for the Olympics, more or less. I think that will freeze things for a while, and there's some major document or discovery made. And I think then kids will get back to school the end of August, and then we'll get underway again after Labor Day. And I think the big thing people will look at will be the debates.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100. Dan is joining us from Des Moines. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Hey, I think it's interesting that we talk about Romney's finances, but I'm curious, have you spent a half an hour's time ever on all the missing documentation and information on President Obama's past, like his academic records and so on? I'm more curious about stuff like that than I am another 6 years of Romney's finances. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know more about Obama myself.
Okay.
About a half an hour of that someday.
Okay. Dan, let's get a reaction to your comment. Dennis, Chris, would you like to answer, react?
Dan, why are you concerned about his academic records?
Why am I concerned?
Yeah.
Because I'd like to know what his history is academically. I think it's related to his qualifications as a candidate.
Have you looked into Romney's?
I'm
just asking to see where you are on that.
Obama's been asked for his records, and he refuses to give them. It's not just a matter of me wanting to know. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of him refusing to release them. Aren't you curious yourself?
Not tremendously.
I see. Well,
for either one.
This is one of the reasons why people don't listen to public radio if they're on the wrong side of the fence. Because you guys slant everything to the left.
Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Dan, calling from Des Moines. We're going to take a short break in just a moment. We'd like to invite you to join with your opinion. 1-866-780-9100 as we look at the political landscape with Chris Larimer and Dennis Goldford. Before we go to the break, I want to mention what's coming up. You mentioned the Veep Stakes, often referred to. Of course, that's still coming up. Dennis, when will that likely be announced? A lot of speculation, and we'll talk about that in the second half hour. When will Mitt Romney ideally pick a running mate and announce it?
They'll decide when strategically it will do them the most good and have the most impact. I don't think they would do it during the Olympics, maybe just afterwards. But Edwards was the one announced the earliest in 2004 by John Kerry. But they'll make the calculation as to when they think it will have the biggest impact.
Okay, we'll come back with talk about possible vice presidential picks for candidate Romney when we return. Also, some news from Iowa politics. We'll discuss a Republican in a competitive Iowa Senate district who not only withdrew from the race but also rejected our system of government, a curious chapter being written in Iowa politics. We'll find out about that when we return. We'd like to have your thoughts about this campaign, politics. What politics are on your mind? Still 15 weeks until the general election. Are the ads you're seeing swaying you? Are they making you more cynical, perhaps, about our political process? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Back with Chris Larimer and Dennis Goldford after a short break. This is Iowa Public Radio's River to River. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us here over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, our guest, political analysts this week. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa invite you to join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, tweet us at IPR Talk. And we do have a full bank of phone calls to get to. Email before we do go to callers. Eric in Iowa Falls listening. He writes, I saw the Obama ad with Mitt singing. Hilarious. I laughed and laughed. The worst part of this whole campaign, other than its length and cost, is that the candidates, media, and public talk about nothing other than the ads and political strategy. Important issues about what policies would actually be implemented by either of these duds, says Eric, are completely lost in the maelstrom. I also think this presidential election echoes our most recent gubernatorial election here in Iowa, incumbent Democrat Dud versus challenging Republican Dud. It's a lose-lose for us. Good job to Dennis, writes Eric in Iowa Falls. Let's go to Jim in Grinnell. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling River to River, 1-866-780-9100.
Hi.
Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yep. I just wondered, it seems to me there's a pretty hard-nosed set of liberals and a pretty hard-nosed set of conservatives as a percent of the population, and a group that's undivided. I always wondered if the undivided are the same percent or same body of people that just don't vote. And why do we spend $1 million a day to find that one half of 1% or whatever?
Right. Interesting. I wonder if Chris or Dennis have the answer to that. The undecided voters, how many of them are just apathetic and will likely not vote at all? Do we know?
I'm not sure we know an exact percentage, but I think it's a good question. You know, and really when we're talking about independence, it's really hard to find a true independent. Most people who say they're independent tend to lean to the right or tend to lean to the left a little bit. And so when you're trying to find a true independent and then you're trying to look at, you know, their vote history or their participation patterns, that's the information that we would really need to see, you know, is this person actually interested in politics and are they actually participating in politics? Mm-hmm. I think that's just a little bit of an unknown at this point.
What's the wildest expectation we could have for a high turnout in the general election? Half the people?
No, I mean, we could see maybe 55 to 60%.
Okay, roughly half the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jason is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Jason. Welcome to River to River.
Well, hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, what's on your mind, Jason?
Well, my comments is just along the line of your last caller. I was actually going to say this election, from what I've seen so far, is almost playing like a South Park cartoon. Hmm. They had an episode a few years ago where there was two different mascots the school had to vote on, and one of the mascots was a turd sandwich. The other one was a feminine hygiene product, and they spent the majority of their debate going, he's a turd sandwich. Who would elect a turd sandwich? That's what's going on here at the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
And when your previous caller asks about how many people actually vote in the election, I went to D.C. last year for a school, a week-long class, that taught me that 3% of the population is what campaigns target to win elections. Overall, when you break down the numbers, who they need to convince is only 3% of the overall population, and that's how they get a majority vote. So we're stuck with two idiots. We don't have either one offering any solutions. They're talking about how each one is awful, and the populace is disengaged. I think if people got up off the couches and went and voted for Gary Johnson this November on the Libertarian ticket, or even Virgil Good for the Constitution Party, just get a third party in there, rather than having two idiots yelling at each other about how...
Well, I'm sorry, Jason. Jason in Des Moines, sorry to cut you off there. I didn't mean to do that, Jason in Des Moines. I think we got your point, though. Let's compare the campaigns. Obviously, Jason, they're disgusted in the two main political parties. Any viability of a third party? We have had it in past presidential elections. Dennis, anything?
No.
No.
Period.
No, period. Okay.
There have always been minor parties in American politics, usually state-based or regionally based.
Mm-hmm.
The last time a third or minor party displaced one of the two major parties was 150 years ago, when the Republican Party was founded in 1854 and displaced the Whig Party, which dissolved under the pressures of slavery and sectionalism and so forth. But we've had some third-party movements, the Populist Party in the 1890s. George Wallace got 13.5% of the vote and some electoral votes in 1968. And Ross Perot had about 19% of the popular vote but no electoral votes in 1992. But the last time a third party actually displaced one of the two major parties was in the 1850s.
Hmm. John is joining us from Mason City. Hi, John. Welcome to our program.
Hello. Sorry about that.
No, John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just going to say that I voted for Ron Paul in the caucuses here in Iowa, and you know, since he's not going to be running, I absolutely would not be voting for Mitt Romney. I know that sounds like an oddity, but I consider them to be totally on opposite spectrums of.
So, what are you weighing in your mind? Are you going to vote definitely? Go to the polls?
I'll definitely vote. I actually voted for Barack Obama the first go around, And although I was a little disenfranchised, mostly because the war is still continuing and the bailout. But I would rather keep the people that are in there right now to continue working on the situation than bring in a whole new group of people that I think have completely extreme ideas.
Okay, John, thank you for that call from Mason City. Comment on Ron Paul. What will be his influence, if any, come convention time?
I think his supporters certainly want to make a big splash at the convention, and they're very interested in, as cause groups normally are in either party, very interested in having an impact on platform provisions. But as far as we know, there's no plan to disrupt anything. I think they want to show that they've had a legitimate cause and a legitimate candidate, and they want to have their moment in the sun. Many of them think that they are laying the groundwork for a future movement. It's bigger than just this particular primary season and general election season.
Let me ask the two of you for your favorites in the Veep Stakes, the top vice presidential picks that people have been batting around. Dennis, you commented on the likely time that would be announced by Mitt Romney. But I'd like to see maybe one, two, three picks that you think are very high on that list. May I start with you, Chris?
Sure. You know, if you believe the rumors, certainly Rob Portman, senator from Ohio, and former governor of Minnesota Tim Pawlenty seem to be the top two, at least, names that are being batted around as potential VPs. Beyond that, it's a little bit difficult. You know, perhaps someone like Representative Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, if the budget and the deficit continue to be of some concern for voters. But, the main idea with a VP candidate is you want someone who's acceptable, but then also someone who excites the electorate a little bit and even more so maybe gives them confidence that this person is helping you in some way. And, you know, we all know about the political stakes of this. You know, you hope that by picking someone that they're going to help deliver a state or deliver you some votes. In that case, you know, someone like Rob Portman would make sense if he can help deliver Ohio. You know, Minnesota is probably not going to go for Mitt Romney. Wisconsin certainly is a little bit more competitive this time around, but I'm not sure that it will. There's a real high likelihood of that going to Romney. So, if you add it all up, Rob Portman seems like a popular choice.
River to River listeners, who would you like to see on the ticket with Mitt Romney? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Who are your top two or three picks, Dennis, for Mitt Romney? What would you advise?
Well, I think for Governor Romney, part of the argument for so long has been in Republican circles that you had a pretty young, untested, inexperienced senator from Illinois get the Democratic nomination and assume the presidency. And so they've claimed that he hasn't had the background and experience to be president. So if you're going to be consistent with that and not have that come back to haunt you, you don't want to pick someone who's vulnerable to the same sorts of charges. So there are a number of people talked about who really are fairly young up-and-comers among Republicans, like Bobby Jindal, Kelly Ayotte, the new senator from New Hampshire, the only woman in the mix. So that would cut them out. I think, and again, I have no name picks, but I think for Romney, it would likely be someone who would be kind of a CEO type. In other words, Romney prides himself evidently as being the kind of executive CEO, the strong business manager, very data-driven and so forth. And I would tend to think he would go with somebody like that. Now, of course, the McCain people wanted a game changer, to use the name of the movie and title and the book and everything. And they went for charisma rather than competence in the minds of Republicans in 2008. And it's still being fought over to this day whether that came back to haunt them or not. Mm-hmm. But I'd be surprised if Romney picked someone who would overshadow him, since he himself is sort of beige. So, you want beige and beiger, I guess.
You mentioned the 2008 campaign and the strategy. I wonder your thoughts about comparing President Obama's 2012 strategy, this year's strategy, to his 2008 strategy. With these hard-hitting ads, we started off the show, does he Does President Obama, you think, Chris, risk ruining his brand of hope? That was the one word that stood out in 2008. That hope got him elected, didn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely did. And, you know, that the hope theme was a theme that resonated with a lot of people, with a lot of voters. And that came that campaign was a lot about mobilizing voters. It was based a lot on voter mobilization. You know, can we get these people out? They're obviously excited. Let's get them over to our side. I think if we fast forward to 2012, you know, both campaigns seem to be talking more about, they're certainly interested in voter mobilization, but now it's a little bit more about voter persuasion. You know, can we bring people back to our side or pick people off that maybe are leaning one way or the other? So I think that's maybe just sort of the overarching theme and the difference between 2008 and 2012.
Your comment on the difference between these 4 years in the meantime?
My argument back then was, as I looked at the top three Democrats running for the nomination, was that Hillary Clinton was trying to run from the center and John Edwards was trying to run from the left and Barack Obama was trying to run from above. And what I meant by that at the time was that he was running against politics as usual and trying to be this post-partisan president. And I cautioned back then, saying anytime somebody tries to run against politics, it comes back and bites you in the bottom at some point later on. And I think he's experienced that in trying to deal with the Republican Congress. So I think these sorts of ads now are just sort of rough, hardball politics of the sort that he didn't seem to think he needed last time, although many people will say they did run tough ads against Hillary Clinton. But it's a tougher campaign because last time around, independents were pretty well fed up with Republicans, as the 06 race showed us, and certainly what happened in 08. But as the 2010 election showed us, independents have lost patience with the Democrats, and they swung strongly to the Republicans. And so President Obama and his people have got to fight for that independent vote a lot harder than they did last time.
Let's spend a few minutes in closing talking about a curious happening on the political landscape right here in Iowa. The race in Iowa Senate District 34 has taken an odd turn. Republican candidate Randy Shannon, who was supposed to challenge Democratic Senator Liz Mathis in November, has announced she's leaving the race. And here are a couple of interesting excerpts from her four-page resignation letter. She writes, "Let me now announce to everyone in Iowa, I have become aware of the existence of the original Republic of the United States of America. This is the republic founded in 1787, then abandoned during the Civil War in the 1860s. It was then replaced in 1871 by the United States Corporation. The de facto United States Corporation, having no standing, must go away." On and on, this four pages, she concludes, "Therefore, in order to effect the most good on behalf of the people of Iowa's 34th District and in keeping with my conscience, I have accepted the position of U.S. Senator in the Republic of the United States of America, where I may better serve you and all the people of Iowa." Now, Randy Shannon was a guest yesterday on a webcast hosted by former state lawmaker and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ed Fallon. Fallon asked Shannon what she hopes to accomplish as a U.S. Senator for the Republic of the United States.
Well, I have a lot to learn by being in the Republic, and just as I would have in the state Senate. I am glad that I walked away from it. I do believe that I will have, even if it's in your eyes, not as great of an impact, for me at least I'll be able to sleep at night.
Not as great of an impact. What is going on here, Chris Larimer?
Thanks.
Have at it, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not sure.
In case someone thinks they tuned into another planet's political system.
Yeah, you know, I like the confidence. I like the self-appointment powers. That's impressive. But, you know, from a strategic standpoint, I'm sure the Republican Party of Iowa is a bit frustrated. You know, going into the fall, if I looked at the numbers right, I think there were 9 Democratic incumbents, state Senate incumbents up for election or re-election, and you know, all 9 were opposed, and now you have one that's unopposed. And for a Senate that was 26-24, that's got to hurt a little bit.
Mm. Okay. It puts into question, doesn't it, Dennis Goldford, the mechanism, the process by which a party nominates a candidate?
Well, our parties are fairly decentralized. Certainly, there's no national party with top-down authority. State parties are pretty much on their own. National parties are basically confederations of state parties. And you get outliers at times in state parties. I mean, look, we got Jesse Ventura in Minnesota. Now, he was a bit better known than this particular candidate, and he ran simply as an independent as opposed to being a senator from the Republic of the United States. That's, of course, not a mainstream view, very unconventional. I don't know that most people would be very comfortable with that idea. But you can get candidates who sort of show up out of nowhere. And in low visibility races especially, it's all a question of who turns out to vote. And if you don't get a lot of people turning out to vote, a small organized group, no matter how unconventional, can sometimes score an upset.
Mm-hmm. Chris, is it really likely that Liz Mathis will run unopposed? The convention will nominate someone else, surely.
Surely they will. And it'll be interesting to see who they can get to do that, because I think this is a bit of a setback. But they're going to have to, now they're going to be scrambling for a bit. They certainly still have time. I think a lot for most voters in the state of Iowa, a state Senate race, is not high on the radar when you have a presidential campaign going on. So they still have a little bit of a time, but it sets them back in terms of contacting voters, getting the voter lists, figuring out who potential voters are, and that sort of thing. So they still have time to make it up, but this is got to look a little strange to voters in that district.
But I would say that for people who are concerned about the Varnum same-sex marriage decision, whether you're for it or against it, 2012 in Iowa is all about the Iowa Senate, even mm-hmm. more so than for the presidential race.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple minutes left. Perhaps you can tell us what major questions haven't been asked this hour, Dennis, that you think should be or what you'll be keeping your eye on in the coming weeks.
Well, as a couple of the callers suggested with some frustration, what will these guys really do in terms of trying to get us off what seems to be dead center with regard to fixing the economy? I mean, Governor Romney can talk about a 59-point program, does it really – I don't know. I think I looked at it when it first came out, but does something actually stand out in my mind that I noticed and say, okay, that's what it's all about?
Mm-hmm.
No. And the president seems to be struggling to figure out what he would do that he hasn't done so far. So, yeah, I mean, there's tremendous voter frustration because you get all these fireworks. There's a lot more heat than there is light, and everybody wants the economy to get put back together.
What will you be looking at, Chris Larimer?
I'll be looking for a nice, happy, positive campaign at some point.
Where are you going to move to?
Yeah.
I got a bridge in Brooklyn for you.
There you go. Well, going back to what we started the show off, how each side is going to try to shift the campaign narrative. So far, we seem to be stuck in the same one for the last couple of weeks. And just watching to see how that changes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, specifically looking at Iowa here in this presidential election. George W. Bush narrowly won in 2004 over John Kerry before President Obama. Candidate Obama won by 9 points last time around in 2008 over John McCain. Iowa now down one electoral vote, 6 votes, but still, Mr. Obama, Mitt Romney, see this state as winnable. It's a swing state. So it's funny, isn't it, Dennis, that Iowa, after the caucuses, does not drop off the map?
Right, as you've probably heard me say at times. But anytime a race is close, my metaphor is always that a feather on the scale can make a difference. And Iowa's 6 little electoral votes are more than a couple of states, but they're still pretty much of a feather. But both races think that it could well be that close, that it could depend on 6 votes. 2000 certainly did.
Mm-hmm. What do you see, Chris, you start us off here. We've just got a minute or so left, but closing thoughts on what is the key to winning Iowa?
I think the key to winning Iowa is appealing to the independent voters in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Any special geographic regions, rural, urban? Other groups?
Well, I think independents are all over the place. Certainly, though, if you can ratchet up the turnout in the eastern part of the state and the urban areas, that's going to help you out as far as winning the state.
What do you think is the key, Dennis, to winning Iowa?
Well, for a Democrat, the key is to roll up big majorities in, I think, 5 key counties, Lynn, Polk, Johnson, Scott, Blackhawk, and you could throw in Dubuque there as well. You've got to roll up big majorities in those counties because Democrats who run statewide generally tend to lose the total vote in the other 93 counties.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much for offering your political expertise and views this week on Our Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks to you both.
Very welcome.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan and technical support from Jeff Schmidt, who is the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow we're going to focus on what is unfortunately turning out to be the big news of this summer, perhaps of the year, the drought. Officially a drought. We'll focus on that tomorrow, find out what's causing it and what its effects have been. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Join us again tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.